Our next case this morning is number 063077, Patel against the Attorney General.
Morning, Your Honors. Raymond Sanders on behalf of Shahzad Patel. Two or three key areas need to be focused on. The first is Lozada. The court has said you didn't meet Lozada. You didn't tell the attorneys what the complaint was. But they're being very rigid in reading the requirements, and the insight in Lozada, which said that you have to send a retainer or an affidavit. You have to show that the attorneys have been given a copy of the charge against them, and you must have shown that you have reported to, in our case, the ARDC, or say, why not? Really, what's behind this, in theory, is that the regulations want a complaint to ARDC, and they know that the ARDC is going to send a copy there. They also want a copy of any retainer agreement or an affidavit that explains it. And if there was no complaint to ARDC, then you must explain why there was no complaint and that you therefore had to send a copy of the complaint against the attorneys directly to them instead of through the ARDC. We communicated to the BIA that a complaint was filed, and we indicated that, and additionally, a copy was sent directly to the attorneys to make sure that they got it directly. Our contention is that a copy of the ARDC complaint is notice that a copy went to the attorney. I do not know of any ARDC equivalent in any state that would not send a copy of the complaint to the attorney complained against. And I think judicial notice would have been simple enough to take that into account and have the BIA be a little more cognizant of these situations, their attorneys up there also. The second requirement that the copy of the retainer be given, the court simply said you didn't send documents, therefore you didn't meet Lozada. Well, there were no retainer agreements, despite the fact that the Illinois Bar is required to use a written retainer with every client that they sign up. And to say that if you don't send a copy because the attorney has violated their duty, you're penalizing the alien for the failure of the attorney. And the affidavit that was given was pretty much ignored as to what the duty of the attorney was to file the motion in the case of Mr. Hong. And it was given by evidence in the form of an affidavit, which under most contract circumstances would have put the burden on the government or Mr. Hong to come and say, well, no, this was not the agreement. Therefore, I think the BIA is wrong to say that Lozada is not complied with and they should have reopened. And I would ask this court to correct the situation and send it back to the immigration judge or the BIA. Why set for adjustment of status? Because there was various degrees of ineffective counsel, primarily with Attorney Hong. He did not give reasonable representation, which is the standard that is looked to from any attorney that represents a client. He first of all waited 5 months to file what they call the I-485, which is the document justifying and showing that he's eligible for adjustment of status. He had ample time also to file what's called a motion to terminate proceedings. If the alien can show that he is completely eligible to do an adjustment of status, and the government agrees that, yes, the documentation is there, even though they reserve the right to dispute it, they can terminate the proceedings and send it back to the service rather than take up court time and have the court do administrative duties. And this is where Hong failed. He did not, in the 5 months that he took to prepare the 485 after the approval of the previous I-140 was given, he could have had this down with the Immigration Service rather than continuing to go to master hearings. Also, he went to see the Assistant District Counsel just before the hearing that Mr. Shazad missed. And it would have been very easy at that time to say, oh, why don't we do a joint motion and not have to have anybody appear? The judge will take it under consideration and give us a decision, send it back to the service. It would have helped things immensely. Also, Hong did not listen to his client and provide good communications. He told one story, it was an uncle. The real facts were that it was an aunt, and it wasn't just in the hospital. It was terminal illness, very serious. As an attorney, you have a duty to know all the facts, to present them to the court. And he didn't really make much of an effort that I can see to tell the court, hey, the situation was entirely different. We must look to the totality of the situation from Mr. Shazad. He comes from the East, the value of the family and the situation and the honor of the family was a stress for him to try to meet our requirements and balance them with the others. The situation goes on to show that this ineffective counsel was the basis for justifying exceptional circumstances to justify his not being at the hearing. I'll wait for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. We'll hear from Ms. Meyer now.
May it please the Court. Anne Meyer again for the United States Attorney General. Petitioner's claims are problematic for a number of reasons, and the government's brief sets forth those problems. The biggest hurdle for which he cannot overcome is the problem of his inability to establish prejudice. Considering the circumstances, petitioner did not show up for the immigration hearing at which he was issued a removal order, not just because his counsel had advised him as he has alleged, but because he chose not to. He was fully cognizant of the consequences if he failed to appear. In fact, there is no dispute that he was advised orally and in writing of the consequences if he did not show up for his hearing, and that the only excuse for that would be exceptional circumstances. And he understood those exceptional circumstances. They're defined by the statute, and he was advised of them. And that is that exceptional circumstances refers to circumstances such as serious illness of the alien or death of an immediate relative of the alien, but not including less compelling circumstances. There is, again, no dispute that the family friend that he had gone to see was not an immediate relative.
How do we know this from the record?
Your Honor,
the administrative record.
Your Honor, there's some confusion in terms of the administrative record. There's some indication that initially his prior counsel, Mr. Hong, had indicated that it was an uncle, but then later on he attested in his motions to reopen that it was a close family friend who he considered to be like a mother to him. So there's no dispute that there was no immediate relative here, and the record does not.
How about you made the statement that he had been advised of the consequences of not appearing at the first hearing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Where is that in the administrative record?
Your Honor, if Your Honor refers to pages 150 to 157 and 161 to 162 of the record, that it will indicate that he was notified of the consequences of his failure to appear. So ultimately, whatever his conversations may have been with his counsel, he was fully cognizant of the consequences if he did not appear. And in fact, he chose to leave the day before the hearing to go to Texas and attend to his family friend. So ultimately, regardless of whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel here, if there was any kind of error, he still cannot establish any prejudice, because even had his counsel represented him as he wished he did, or as he alleged he should have, then ultimately an in absentia order of removal would still have been issued. So aside from that...
Because he ignored the warning? Or I'm not sure I understand your logic of that.
Yes, Your Honor, because he knew that what would occur would be that there would likely be an in absentia order of removal if he did not appear, and he chose not to appear. So had his...
In other words, even if his counsel gave him other advice, he should have ignored that?
Yes, Your Honor, because clearly the record reflects that he was aware of the consequences. And the record also suggests that his counsel did not advise him not to show. And in fact, his own evidence that is not in the record reflects that his counsel disagrees and contests the allegations that he has asserted. Of course, the admission of the new evidence he's now submitted before the court is not subject to review. The admission of that evidence, in fact, shows that the board was correct in denying his appeal and his motion to reopen, because that evidence should have been submitted to the board in the first instance. So here what we have is a case of a petitioner who did not establish the scope of representation by his different attorneys, nor did he establish that he had advised prior counsel of the actual allegations of ineffective assistance of counsel and provided them with an opportunity to respond. He alleges here, for the first time before the court, that there should be some sort of presumption based on the fact that an ARDC complaint was filed. He did not argue this before the board, thus that argument is not exhausted and cannot be considered. Moreover, there's no case law to substantiate such a presumption. So ultimately, petitioner cannot overcome the hurdles that are presented before his case, and the board's decision, it was well within its exercise of discretion. Thus, the court should deny the petition for review. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mai. How long does Mr. Saunders have? 2 minutes, sir.
Yes, I don't believe there is precedent. This is the time to establish a precedent for logic and compassion. And the dwelling on immediate family only is not what the Act said. Counsel just said, or not less compelling. And this is a compelling circumstance that justifies the exceptional
Sanders,
circumstance.
Do you dispute that the administrative record does reflect that your client was warned of the consequences of not being present at the first hearing?
I was not there. There is something in the administrative record that shows that he may have been warned. But it's not the warning. It's why he missed it. And does he justify for the exceptional circumstance? And the prejudice that was involved was because of the ineffective counsel and the compelling reasons. This was a godmother. In their religion is a very important person to the individual. Thank you.
And the advice of counsel was an interpretation of the warning. Is that what you're saying? He got a warning, but he also, on top of the warning, he got advice of counsel, which interpreted the warning.
I'm not sure of all the advice that he got, but it didn't seem to be very good advice, and it was very cursory, and it was go, don't go, I'll try to get somebody to get an extension, I'll try to get the counsel to agree. He was at times saying, come on, I'll find some way to get you. There was no warning to him that he was aware of that would have not allowed him to come to the hearing.
Well, your opponent has said that there wasn't any prejudice from the advice of counsel because he got the warning.
I don't know of any cases that hold that. But there was prejudice because he was also denied his due process of reasonable representation. And that was also a basis for prejudice. And also the non-disclosure of the totality of the circumstances to the immigration judge and what was the reality of it.
Well, the issue seems to be whether he did what he did because he ignored the warning or because he paid attention to his lawyer, as I understand the argument against you. Now, whether that makes any sense, I don't know at this point.
But. Well, I do believe he was misled by his lawyer because they said, well, I'll find a way, and then suddenly at the last minute, I can't find a way. And I think that the attorney missed ways to do it and was also ineffective in that respect, and that this was prejudicial to the whole case. He didn't get his case presented. That's lack of due process. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Sanders. The case will be taken under advisement with our thanks to both counsel.